All right, maybe I'll leave that up there, and I just erased the wrong thing. Let's take this out, and we're moving on to the second of these two books on the fall of the devil. And one of the things you're going to realize right away is we're not really going to start talking about something different. It's just the stage and the step is moved back from Adam and Eve and the whole human race back to Lucifer specifically. But really, we're not really going to be having a different focus. There's a way to read it and have a different focus and just to focus on the speculative, what was happening back there beyond what Scripture says, but that's not going to be our approach. This is really going to touch upon the nature of good and evil, and it's not going to leave behind the question of will. The first sections are biggest, and that's just the nature of the angelic beings. And when you read that, just understand that to be the same thing as the essence or the nature of the will, the nature of good that we looked at already. And interestingly, the book starts by quoting the verse 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 7, where Paul has a very immediate audience in mind. He says, "What do you have that you did not receive?" And I don't think the teacher and the student of Anselm's dialogues are unaware of the immediate audience of that book and how that's relevant. They're just asking the question about all personal beings. In other words, if that applies to all human beings, does it not apply to all personal beings, all creatures? And of course, if you ask it like that, of course it does. And so that's what they assume. And at first, Anselm is going to follow Augustine directly. There's being, and then strictly speaking, there's not non-being. So, in other words, there's not being and non-being, because non-being is not a thing. So the question is, what is there? There's being, a better way to say it, it's not exactly the way he says it, but there's being and becoming. There's being, and what we said a couple weeks ago, the way Plato would have put it, is participation in being. Now, we could say there's the creator, and there's the creation. But there's being, and there's not non-being. And so, even in the case, as Anselm says, quote, when he stops preserving what he made, it is not the case that he turns what was a being into non-being, as if he caused non-being, but only that he stops causing it to be. The thing reverts to the non-being it had of itself before it was created. So we kind of covered that in the first class. When God ceases to preserve to some degree, when he lets something go, permits being to disintegrate toward non-being, it is not that God is creating non-being. Because non-being, strictly speaking, is not an effect. Now, you might say that becoming, or a lesser degree of being, then another being can still have being. But you can't say non-being has being. So God does not have to, nor can he, create non-being. It's like a square circle. Rather, he is letting go, and the being who does not have the power of being within itself is reverting to the non-being it had of itself before it was created. That is just a thing, being itself. If you are a created nature, you are created out of nothing. If you are a creature, and God does not uphold you or speak you into existence, then at that point where his decree stops, you stop. We might summarize the chronological account of Anselm's explanation by two syllogisms. We're going to write a couple syllogisms on the board. These first two are just what I think are a good summary of the first couple sections of the book about the very beginning. It's talking about being and persevering these angels in being. You might say preserving these angels in being. So premise one, all good things come from God. All good things come from God. Very uncontroversial as a Christian. And of course, he's not doing apologetics to an unbeliever in this book. He's talking to Christians. All good things come from God. Premise two, perseverance is a good thing. See, that's arbitrary. Who says? Well, remember how we define the will. The will itself is going to seek its own happiness, and you have to be in order to be happy. Happiness is just a predicate of being. So you have to be there to be happy, and so every will, by definition, sees perseverance as a good thing. In other words, continuing to exist. Continuing on in existence. Therefore, perseverance comes from God. So you see how that follows. If all good things come from God, and if perseverance is a good thing, therefore perseverance comes from God. Pretty non-controversial. But that's a good summary of his first couple sections. Section 2. Let's just put it right under. Because what I want to do is I want to circle my two conclusions, because I'm going to build my next argument on these two conclusions. This is an exercise in how to think beyond just 30 seconds. This is an exercise in how to put two truths together as a third truth. Okay? So, second syllogism that I think accurately represents his next section. Premise one, no reprobate has perseverance. Sorry, no reprobate will. The question is the will. He's focusing in. No reprobate will has perseverance. And all that means is that they don't exemplify the quality of persevering. So don't have in your, you know, like some object in a bag or something. No reprobate will has perseverance. Premise two, all demons or all fallen angels, let's just put demons, all demons are reprobate wills. And again, all reprobate means is non-elect. So already it's going to be definitionally the same thing. The reprobate will is just one that is not, it is at least that much, one that is not persevering. Conclusion, therefore no demons have perseverance. Okay, so if anybody's familiar at all with the rules for categorical syllogisms, everybody would recognize these as two valid and somewhat simple syllogisms. Again, we're assuming a Christian audience, so we're not really dealing with the soundness of these premises, because these are straightforward from a Christian perspective. We're just dealing with the logic of it. Okay? So if you reason in this way, all we're going to do is we're going to put these two conclusions together, or we're going to take what we've learned, or what we've agreed to as a result of these two lines of reasoning, and we're going to put them together as premises in our next argument. We're going to build on this reasoning to further reasoning. We're going to take perseverance comes from God and no demons have perseverance as our two premises of our next argument. And I'd leave it on there, but they're on your notes anyway. I'd leave it on there, but I need more room. So, from those two arguments, we have our two premises in the next, and this is actually going to be improper at first. So let's do a little bit of exercise in logic. And I'm trying to double up here. I'm trying to save myself time here. I'm coming up with notes for my logic class at the same time. So bear with me. So, but this will be a good exercise. No demons have perseverance. That was one of the conclusions we had. We're going to plug it into a premise of our next argument. No demons have perseverance. I'm also doing this to show you how easy it is to make a mistake in reasoning, even with statements that are completely true, and to come up with something that's false with only true statements. Premise two, all perseverance comes from God. Remember, those are our two conclusions from those last two bits of reasoning. All perseverance comes from God. Again, we saw that each of those statements were sound, and that those arguments were valid. So no problem believing these two things. Therefore, no demons have what can only come from God. No demons have what can only come from God. Now, I'm going to ask you what I'm going to ask the kids. And I would say, don't worry, there's no wrong answers, but that's not true. There is. Is this a valid syllogism? And Anselm makes all these steps in his reasoning, even if he doesn't put any of this together as a... another reason I'm doing this, by the way, is to show you how much Anselm is thinking and still goes in the wrong direction after this, which is really interesting. So I'm doing this for a lot of reasons. Just trust me on this for a second. Okay? No demons have perseverance. We saw that that was sound and it came from a valid argument. All perseverance comes from God. We saw that was sound and it comes from a valid argument. And this does seem to follow from these two premises. No demons have perseverance. All perseverance comes from God. Therefore, no demons have what can only come from God. Well, you don't have to know anything about the five rules of categorical syllogisms. You just give you a little crash course. You need to have three terms. You got that. There's one. There's another. There's another. There's my three terms. They need to be in the right place. You need a middle term. Got it. Your major term has to be the subject of the conclusion and has to be in the major premise. Your minor term has to be in the minor premise. That's the second. It has to be the predicate of your conclusion. That's rule number one. Does it pass? Yes. And it can't equivocate. Your terms have to mean the same thing. Looks like everything does there too. That works. The second rule, don't worry about it, it passes that too. It's the third rule that becomes a problem. The third rule of categorical syllogisms, basically, let's say it like this, because it's not a logic class. You have to have, imagine this as a bucket. In deductive reasoning, you're learning this way. You're starting with assumptions, and you want your conclusion to follow from your premises. In other words, though your conclusion might be sound, it might be a true statement, it might not follow from your premises. So think of a mountain with an ice cap, water coming down. Where does the water come from? It's got to come from the top. Well, it's the same thing here. You can't have more in the bottom of your bucket than you actually poured in. Think of it like that. So think of it as the water in the bucket rule. Yeah, that's what we're going to think of it as. It's actually called, this particular fallacy is called the fallacy of the illicit middle. Your middle term, sorry, not middle term, minor term. The fallacy of the minor term. Your minor term, you're actually going to have more water, where's blue? You're going to have more water in the bottom of the bucket than you poured in. You poured in a drop, and you got a whole ton. And you're like, well, where did that come from? It might be a true statement, but it just didn't come from here. Okay, so let's look at it and see what happens. And here's the technical word for it. This term up here is not distributed. In other words, this term is not talking about everything in its class. Down here it is. You can't do that. You can't say one thing about God over here, it applies to one thing, and then say everything about Him down here. Okay? That might be a true statement, but you just didn't get it from your premises. So if you look at this over here, all perseverance comes from God. Obviously, everything about perseverance is going to be talked about over here. If it's perseverance, it comes from God. But, if something comes from God, is it always perseverance? Okay. Now, let's look down here. No demons have what can only come from God. That's a type E statement in logic. You're negating something, but you're saying everything about that class. No demon. If it's a demon, it can't have what can only come from God. So it's kind of one of those no SSP kind of statements. No demon can have what can only come from God. Now this is a good thing coming from God. We're assuming that up front because we already proved that in the first argument. Okay? So, if it's something that can come from God that's good, it doesn't belong to this class at all. Here, my term, something's coming from God, is talking about everything in the class. Here, it's not. And so this conclusion actually does not follow from the premise. It is an invalid argument. Okay? Now, again, I'm doing that for several reasons. I'm attacking a couple classes at once, but I'm also showing you how much thought Anselm's putting into this question, and he's still going to go wrong. Okay? So hold on to that. It would be better, so you say, okay, if that's a wrong one, that's the right way to say it. Okay, glad you asked. Let's fix this. Here's a better way to say what he wants to say in a right way. And it might just help him actually not make the mistake, too. There's another reason to do this. So, here's the right way to say it. And I believe all four of them are on your notes. Are they? Do you have four syllogisms?
Yeah.
Okay. Here's a better way to say it. And I will grant he did not say it like this, and he shouldn't. Premise one.
None whom God permits to fall persevere.
Now, if you do a little logical translation, you'll realize this whole thing is my term. The ones who God does not permit to fall. This is going to be a separate term right here. Persevere. Premise two.
Some angelic beings are permitted by God to fall. Sorry for my sloppiness. Got to go fast.
Okay, so there's my middle term. Right where it should be. Therefore,
I already wrote that. Darn it. Therefore, some angelic beings do not persevere.
Alright, everything's right where it should be. Got a middle term. Got a major term. Got a minor term. Everything's where it's supposed to be. I haven't equivocated, I promise you, I haven't changed the meaning of any of those terms as I go. And now, everything's only talking about the thing in the class that they're supposed to talk about. So now we have something that says the same thing, but with no formal fallacies. And so far, Anselm looks like he is in unison with Augustine's view of the origin of evil. But here it comes. Here is the surprising departure. In the dialogue, the teacher gets the student to accept, by way of several analogies, that while the giving of the giver is the cause of the receiving of the receiver, think of the gift on Christmas, you see this analogy in this debate, it's down to the present day. While the giving of the giver is the cause of the receiving of the receiver, nevertheless, it does not follow that the non-giving of the giver is the cause of the non-receiving of the would-be receiver. And of course it doesn't follow, given the equal giving of the giver. But that begs the question. Because if I did not give you the same present as I gave your sister, you would not have the same present. Duh. So, Anselm's right. It doesn't follow that they're the same, given the equal giving of the giver. But that's the very question we're asking. And that is the fallacy of begging the question. This very question that Anselm would propose to answer. The student rightly asks, and this is the real thing that will frustrate you if you read this book, Anselm's student keeps pinning the teacher to the wall and he's asking all the right questions. So it's like, Anselm has thought about this. And he still, unless I'm not aware of his literary style and he actually wants the student to win in one of these books. I don't know. But this is frustrating. The student rightly asks why he, Lucifer, the first fallen will, why he doesn't take the gift. Good question, right? Because remember what he's doing? He's saying, sorry, let me write this on the board too. Let me make this picturesque. I am going to assume the best of Anselm and suppose that in his weird literary style, he actually had one where the student won the debate. And that's the point. I doubt it, though. But anyway, the question here, what? That's blue, man. That's blue. That's fluorescent blue. Okay? So, let's, again, in parentheses for God, put the giver. Surely, the giving of the giver is the cause of the receiving of the receiver. Two. But it doesn't follow. Let's put an arrow, and this arrow is going to mean, like in logic, like the horseshoe, the implication. It doesn't follow that, therefore, because the giving of the giver is the cause of the receiving of the receiver, it doesn't therefore follow that the non-giving of the giver is the cause of the non-receiving of the receiver. Of course it doesn't follow in that way, and assuming the equal giving of the giver to both. But that begs the question that we're trying to ask. That doesn't answer it. That's circular reasoning. When you assume in your premise the when you assume in your premise the thing that you're trying to conclude, you put as one of your premises what is supposed to be your conclusion. That's circular reasoning. So, the student rightly asks him why he doesn't take the gift. Number two guy over there on the right. Lucifer in this case. He says, quote, "Either this is because he did not have the capacity, or because he did not want to." Stop, student. You can do a little bit better. Maybe he didn't have the capacity to want. But we'll leave that aside for now. Either this is because he didn't have the capacity, or because he did not want to. If he did not have the capacity or the will to take it, God did not give it to him. Is will a thing or not? According to your view, it's the greatest thing since sliced bread. I think that qualifies it as at least a thing. If will is a thing, did it always exist or did it start to exist? If it started to exist, and we're talking about the beginning, God has to create that effect. If it didn't, it's God. Two gods. Bad. Illogical. So either way, you shoot yourself in the foot. Now, Anselm, or the teacher, sees this, and yet he attempts to carve out a place for a will that is given as good. And he's going to agree with Augustine on that. The will in itself is good. Yet without an inherent corruptibility against what Augustine would say. Astonishingly, what Anselm recognizes in Adam, he ignores in Lucifer. In summary, Anselm's teacher drives his wedge in between God's giving and the angelic beings receiving of the ability to accept perseverance on the one hand, and God's giving and the angels receiving of the perseverance per se. So he makes a distinction between the ability to receive perseverance, put purse right here, versus perseverance per se. And of course, God has to give this, and he's admitting that. He has to give this. Okay? But he's going to make a distinction between this and this. This person has this, they both have this, but this person doesn't have this, and the student's asking, wait a minute, why doesn't he accept that gift? Okay? So this raises a question as to what is the very nature of perseverance. He says that perseverance is to will it all the way. Good enough. I'll accept that definition. Of this lack of desire in the unwilling agent, the student responds. Student, this is a good student. He's asking some good questions. He says, quote, "But is it not clear that he does not will to not keep it because he abandoned it?" Sorry. "Is it not clear that he does not will to not keep it because he abandoned it? But he abandons it. But he abandons it because he does not want to keep it." So in other words, there was a desire to abandon it. You've got to explain that too. He goes on, the student says, "When something is had, not wanting to keep it precedes abandoning it. And one wills to let something go because he does not want to keep it." You see that? So the student is rightly saying, but what explains the desire to not, to abandon this, to abandon perseverance, to have something and to not keep it, if it's a free will, is to have a desire or a preference other than to keep it. So the desire to abandon precedes the abandoning. I think the student's right on. Now the final answer of the teacher is a very clever subterfuge. He brings up the example used before about willing something for its own sake versus the sake of another. He shows an example and then the principle behind it of how the will to abandon may actually precede the will to retain. But that's not going to do anything, because the will to abandon, what is the will? Is it a preference? Is it a desire? A choice of one thing over another? So I'm just throwing it in there. But he says the principle is that, quote, "When you hold something only for the sake of something else, you want to abandon it only for the sake of something else. And you want more the other thing that you cannot have unless you abandon what you have. Then the will to abandon is prior to not wanting to retain." Now let's consider that for a second. The principle is true enough. The trouble is that he's only focusing on the motive of the one who wills and is subtly no longer addressing how such desire comes to be in the first place. Remember the student's question. The question that the student has is not whether This will desires perseverance or something other than, let's call it AP, anti-perseverance. Doesn't matter what it is. Okay? The question is not whether or not this will sees what he ought to. It's a good question. It's a separate question. The question is not instrumental cause. The question is not formal cause, the form of this. The question is efficient cause. What desire, what tendency caused the one or the other? Is this an effect or not? If it is an effect, it must have a cause. And so all he's done is to give a formal cause. Which formal cause is true? We do abandon things for the sake of other things, not for the sake simply of abandoning it, and so on and so forth. That is changing the subject. Changing the subject. The question was one of efficient cause, not formal cause. And unfortunately, the student's resolve folded too easily. And the teacher concludes, quote, "So, I say that the devil did not will what he should have willed when he should have willed it." True. Not because he lacked the will and lacked it because God did not give it to him, which he didn't address, remember. But because willing what he ought not to have willed, we agree, he drove out the good will when the bad will supervened. Therefore, God did not give him the good will to persevere, and he did not receive it. Not because God did not give it, but on the contrary, God did not give it because he gave up willing that he should have willed it by abandoning and not retaining it. And what Anselm does there, unfortunately, is he takes the smaller circle that's inside the bigger circle and takes it out of the bigger circle. He changed the subject, said something true, but something that existed as a smaller circle within the bigger circle. Red herring. That's the formal fallacy. He committed probably some other ones too. I'll think about that. The very next words out of the student's mouth should have been as follows. Quote, this is not in the book. This is my fictional voice in my head that I wrote into the story. "But teacher, it is you who are arguing in a circle. My question was to account for the efficient cause of any such desire for anything other than the good that God is for any created soul at any point. And all you've accomplished in response is to show me that no one would ever consciously will against one's greatest good, but that in absence of perseverance, one is willing, not already desiring evil, but in light of some other good. Simply willing what is not good. But what do you mean by not good, but evil? What is that desire to will what is not good, but an evil desire?" And so we're right back to a desire which is A, an evil desire, and B, an effect. And you have not addressed that question. And by the way, my argument is not an argument from his silence. Because he hasn't addressed it, therefore he's wrong. No, by definition, I'm already right. Let me review. A desire for evil is an evil desire, and B, an effect has a cause. Period. End of story. I'm not right because he hasn't said anything. I'm already right. That's the law of cause and effect. That's the way it goes. If it's an effect, it has a cause. Okay? So remember that up front. There is only one answer to that question. Augustine did a pretty good job of drawing it out. Anyway, he then turns to a positive application to what is known about the devil's fall. It's restated that the first fallen angel desired not to lose what he had so much as to gain what he did not. Again, a mistake on Lucifer's part, pride on Lucifer's part, but it doesn't contradict the principle. This, of course, presents the immediate difficulty that this would make Lucifer able to conceive of nothing and prefer it over something. Remember, there isn't anything outside of God's will. That creates a problem, and Anselm has to deal with it. What is true is rather that Lucifer conceived of what was being in a disordered way. You can never go wrong by thinking of nothing. Go ahead, try. Let me know what you come up with. Whatever it is, it'll be something. So you can never go wrong by thinking of nothing, but rather, you're thinking of something in a disordered way. That implies that when the comparison was made by Lucifer between God and the alleged good of the disorder, the desire for what was becoming was still a desire of and a desire for that which did not have rectitude with God, to use Anselm's own term. A desire of and a desire for that which did not have rectitude with God. The student reminds the teacher at this point that if God is, you love this when your student brings something up against the teacher, hey, I don't remember your other book. Wasn't God that then which nothing greater can be thought? How could the devil will what he could not think? You get the objection? If it is impossible to conceive of the greatest possible being and the devil's desire was precisely to lift himself above the Most High, how could he do that? The teacher concedes, yet responds with a valuable insight. He says, quote, even if he did not will to be wholly equal to God, but something less than God against the will of God, that's crucial. Because that's what the Bible is going to mean by pride. The Bible is not actually conceding that you can think of something higher than the Most High. But it is specifically, even if it's something less than God, something against the will of God. Which again, is an attempt to think of nothingness, to put it in logical terms. But anyway, by that very fact, he inordinately willed to be like God. Because he willed something by his own will as subject to no one. It is for God alone, thus to will something by his own will, such that he follows no higher will. Hopefully you can see on that point that we're not simply talking about some speculative thing back there. This is crucially important for ethics and psychology. Crucially important. In explaining what the devil's sin was, and I'll read it again, that part, by the very fact that he inordinately willed to be like God, because, or in the sense that, he willed something by his own will as subject to no one. It is for God alone thus to will something by his own will, such that he follows no higher will. Can you be guilty of that after the devil did it the first time? Sure, that's the whole essence of every sin. So although the creature cannot will anything other than with the material of what exists, still, the will of desire becomes confused with the will of decree. The will of desire, which is the only will there is, God is not faulting us for having a will. Will is the kind of, he would fault us for not exercising our will. Because that's what we are. But the will of desire becomes confused with the will of decree. Therefore, we cannot consider this question any deeper without exploring the nature of good and evil. So let's do this final section, the nature of good and evil. We'll wrap praise and blameworthiness up into that. But really, this is where all this is going. At least that's what I got out of it. The nature of good and evil. Now, good, there's a first cause and an end cause, which is God. And hopefully, as Anselm's going to have these insights, hopefully you see that this chart has remained with us throughout. There's a first cause and an end cause. And the first cause and the end cause are identical. The first cause, God. The end cause, God. Here's what we mean by that. From Him, that's the first cause. Through Him, that's the instrumental cause. And to Him are all things. That's Romans 11:36. Very Trinitarian. The sovereignty of God and the glory of God. That's what we might call the first and the seventh point of 7 points of Calvin, if you want to say it like that. But it's the first cause and the end cause. God is good. Goodness is God. There's only one who is good, and it's God alone. That's what Jesus said in Luke 18. And so if goodness is the first cause and the end cause, then we're going to want to not forget that as we go on and we fill all the stuff in between. We're going to want to remember that goodness is what it is and never is something else. It never becomes something else. Well, in God it's that, but in us it's, well, what do you mean by that? Do you mean that lower goodness is not reflective entirely of that goodness, that it is ever some other essence? So, all Christian theists will say that they affirm this, that of good there's a first cause and an end cause, and that is God. All Christian theists will say that they affirm this. However, we betray our inconsistencies when we posit any finite thing which originates either moral good or psychological good. Let me say that again. You do not believe in God or logic or being or yourself or anything if you posit any finite thing which originates either moral good or psychological good. If anything less than God is a justification for itself for you, you are at that point irrational. You will eventually go insane. You may not be insane yet, but you will be. Let's define moral good, and these are in your notes, I'm going to define both of these. Let's define moral good as the ultimate essence of one's obligations. And let's define psychological good as the ultimate essence of one's desires. And don't divorce those. The word good has a referent, and there's only one, and it's God. But when we talk about it morally, we mean the ultimate essence of one's obligations. And when we talk about it psychologically, we mean the ultimate essence of one's desires. In contrasting what the devil sought in exchange for what the former angel had, in other words, Lucifer, before he was the devil, he breaks down the good into what was useful to himself or the fitting. And he calls the former happiness and the latter justice. What is useful to himself, or happiness, and what is fitting, or justice. And it's clear that only an eternal, let's do the first one first, justice, or moral good. It is clear that only an eternal first cause can be good in himself, such that only God can demand an unqualified allegiance. Say it another way, only God can explain or command an unqualified obedience or obligation. All other moral obligations are relative to, think of the word relative. Let me stop there. This is not in my notes. Relative. This is relative to that. Are you a relativist? Okay. Time out. Relativism is the worldview that says that everything is just what you say it is. It's relative to the, in other words, when we say relativism in that sense, we really just mean subjectivism. The individual self is defining terms, perspectives, blah, blah, blah. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. The word relative is not a dirty word. If other things exist beside God, then all effects and every predicate in them is always relative. That means that everything you see all the time is always relative. Not to nothing, which is relativism, but to something, the first cause. Or else you don't believe in God. Do you believe that one of those effects is either equal to God or like a second God? Everything is what it is relative to God. So, that's true about moral goodness. All other moral obligations are relative to the rectitude of the actions to His unqualified goodness. All other good is good in another. All other good is qualified by the good. And therefore, all other obligations suffer the fate of an infinite regress of becauses. Why is that good? Because. And why is that good? Because. If they do not terminate on the unqualified goodness of God. In other words, nothing can be objectively good unless the becauses stop and there's a cause. Or it's irrational, blathering nonsense. It's preference. It's emotion. It might make you feel good. But it's not objective good. Well, that's the same true about psychological, the end cause at the end. There has to be an eternal end cause. Only an eternal end can be good in itself. Such that no desire, which is an effect, are all of your desires an effect? Of course, unless you're God. No desire, which is an effect, would ever move, would ever get off the ground toward any end unless the series of subordinate motives terminated on an objective, limitless happiness. He says, quote, he cannot be happy if he does not will happiness. You cannot be happy if you don't will happiness. Happiness, being in God, is an object of being. It's not whatever you want it to be, meaning nothing. It is an object of being. If the human subject is also an object with a nature, and one which is an effect, then the effect does not get to determine his own end. We don't get to determine our own end, not just in a moral sense, but in any sense. These things, happiness, subordinate ends, or how that works, is also an object with a nature. The individual does not get to determine his own end either morally or psychologically, but rather exists with an already prepared objective end of happiness that he cannot cheat without eroding his will to be happy. Not because that's not nice, not because that's the right answer because we're Christians, but because happiness is also an object. Your pursuit of happiness is actually an object. If you do it by some other design. If you pretend to be a rock, you won't be happy. It's not because I'm supposed to be happy and I'm supposed to be nice, i.e. not a rock. No, if you run your head, when we say things like natural law, one of the things we mean is that lowering your head into a wall will hurt. The nature of walls, hard, nature of your head, not tough enough. We don't just mean because mommy said so. We also mean because that's the way it is. Hence, the will cannot originate any objective moral good whatsoever. Hence, the will cannot originate any objective personal value. Those words have no meaning if they don't mean being. Each finite good would be qualified in an infinite regress if an effect could determine that, which, as we've already proven, is impossible. To contemplate the object that became the immediate new end of the fallen angels and of our first parents, Anselm's focus is on the first fallen angel, to contemplate that new end is to see that thing that, if you were here back in Genesis, which is not many people, but I called this thing good and evil that the devil was saying. You'll be like God, knowing good and evil. Sounds like a candy bar. They already knew good. What need did they have to know evil? And what is good and evil? What is good and evil? Let's call that the free will. Call that libertarian free will, to do or do otherwise. This new end is a reduction. It's a reduction to something finite, something temporal, which is to immediately replace God as the essence of good. In other words, what makes decisions so good, not just morally, but psychologically. What will make your will secure and still a will? We could go as far to say that the fundamental essence of the fall, at the DNA level, so to speak, we could go as far as to say that the fundamental essence of the fall was the relativizing or the subjectivizing of good. And this is what it means to reduce God on a philosophical level. Anselm asks the question of the will, whether having only the will for happiness, he is able not to will it. Now, at first, the student takes this to be a contradiction. Having only the will for happiness, he is able not to will it. But he wants to show something. He presses further. Quote, whether he who wills only happiness and cannot will it, can will happiness more the more he understands it. So that's a fair question. Is it possible that whether he who wills only happiness and cannot will it, can will happiness even more if he starts to understand it more? In other words, even if we agree that the will always seeks its highest desire, check, we agree with that, and that the will is the mind choosing, we agree with that, it does not follow that the mind has chosen rightly between subordinate ends. Failing to have rectitude in that hierarchy of being in which both chief end and subordinate end reside. That the will seeks its highest desire does not demand that this mind has the highest view. It may not. And of course, life is made up of countless conflicting choices, each of which conditions and constrains subsequent views toward being. Again, the most extreme example, blowing the brains out, tends to obscure my vision toward understanding what happiness really is. And then go down the scale to less extreme things, and I think you'll see, if you're honest, or you'll start to see that the same thing's happening. Well, Anselm starts out equating to goodness to being, just as Augustine did, but he failed to draw out the implications consistently to the will. But honestly, that's no more troublesome to me than that the early Augustine had fallen short of the same thing, because I'm not as concerned with rooting for setting up mascots with any of these thinkers. I'm looking to study these things. A couple of notes about the nature of final praise and blame. The question during the break, again, and it's the same, it's a great question. We know it's a great question because Paul asked it in Romans 9, why then does he blame us if we are just, in a sense, let's say it a different way, if we are just sinning by necessity? And again, the way the modern world means necessity, or really anybody can make the mistake, is that necessity equals the opposite of freedom. But of course, that's the secondary definition of necessity. The primary definition of the word is it's a logic word, just like nature is a logic word first. It just means A equals A. So freedom has a necessity, or it's not a thing. Okay? So they are primarily identical to each other. They are secondarily separate from each other. The question is, what is the thing determining this choice? Is it extrinsic? Is it an alien force? That really would be a coercion of will. That would not be freedom. Or is it the thing itself doing what it is inclined to do? Okay? So, anyway, with that, I know there's a lot here. There's morality, there's psychology, there's the will, there's the Calvinism, Arminianism debate, and some people might be less interested in Anselm himself. I actually am less interested in him, how Anselm resolved this finally. That's incredibly inconsequential compared to what all the things we can learn from this is. So, let's end it there and open it up to questions about either session today.